See if you're on mute.
Oh, okay. I thought it was on. Good. Thank you very much. Okay. Can you both hear me now? Okay. We're going to have a little demonstration before I call the case about how we keep time when we're having oral arguments virtually. So our marshal will show you a green start sign when it's time for you to begin. When you have 5 minutes to go, she will put up a yellow 5 minute sign. And when it's time to conclude, she'll put up a red stop sign. I will pretty much help you keep track of that red sign and hold you to it unless you are answering a question that a justice has posed. And then you always should finish answering the question. You don't need to get my permission to go forward and do that. So with that little demonstration, I'll call our first case of the morning. State versus, is it Jenkins correctly? Do either counsel know what the correct pronunciation is of our defendant's name?
Your Honor, I pronounce it as Jenis.
Okay.
I think that that's right. That's what I'm going with.
Okay, very good. Thank you for your help. Attorney Rosenau, I think that you are the first attorney up. So if you are prepared to begin, please do.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Attorney Scott Rosenau for the state of Wisconsin. The facts of this case are consistent with a common method of drug dealing. A brief interaction in a vehicle late at night in a high drug trafficking area. And before I get too deep into my argument, I do want to make one slight correction. So on page 16 of my opening brief, I discussed a case from the Court of Appeals called State v. Young, and State v. Young distinguished a federal case called Trello on the grounds that Trello involved a short interaction in a vehicle late at night. So my brief does accurately state what the Young decision says about Trello, but I discovered yesterday afternoon in reading the Trello case that the Young court actually misstated one of the facts from Trello. So Trello did not actually involve late night suspicious activity. The activity in that case occurred around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So I don't think this is a big deal one way or the other. I'm just mostly telling the court because I have a duty of candor. But I think this correction does help the state's position because it shows that one federal appeals court in the Trello case found reasonable suspicion with one of these suspicious facts removed from the case, the late night consideration. So in Trello, the court found reasonable suspicion of drug activity based on two facts, a short interaction in a vehicle and a high crime, high drug area. And this case, Genesis case, involves a lot more suspicious facts than that one, including the late night activity at 3:30 in the morning.
Mr. Rosenau, let's talk about this idea of a high crime area. So Kayla lives there, right? This occurred right in front of her house. So when you talk about the ability to stop people because it's a high crime area, what you're saying is anybody that lives in that area has less Fourth Amendment protections, right? I mean, she lived there. Anybody that came up to her house did something that looks suspicious because it's a high crime area, gives that ability of the officers to stop. So isn't that treating people differently depending on where they live?
No, Your Honor, and I do understand the concern behind that line of questioning, and I think a couple of important things to note. One is that Kayla would be more, maybe more likely to be stopped if she were in her neighborhood as opposed to a neighborhood with less crime. So it's more about where somebody is and about where they live. And another important thing to keep in mind, I think, is that if the court were to just throw out the high crime area consideration like Janice wants the court to do, then police would be hampered in their ability to protect people from crime who live in high crime neighborhoods.
Well, I don't know that that's what Janice is asking or that it follows what you're saying, Mr. Rosenau. I think what Janice is saying is instead of just relying on an officer's generalized sense of an area, which many areas in an urban area like Milwaukee, there could be crime. Instead of this general idea, to have a requirement or at least some kind of bolstering of those statistics, like We know for a fact that drugs have been dealt in this area in the last couple of weeks because we had reports of it, or something more specific. What's wrong with something like that to ensure that people that live in neighborhoods where there's crime have the same Fourth Amendment protections?
Well, a couple of points. So I guess, first of all, this court in Stavey Morgan 25 years ago addressed this consideration or this concern and said that it's not really a big concern because presence alone in a high crime area is not grounds for stopping somebody, even if it's late at night. So there does have to be suspicious behavior. There has to be something more than just presence in a high crime area. And more to the point, I suppose, like the state concedes that if there were more facts showing a lot of like statistical facts showing how many drug arrests or something there were in this neighborhood in recent weeks or months, then that would certainly help support the state's argument for reasonable suspicion. So I think ultimately how much information there is about the high crime nature just goes to the weight of that factor in the analysis. It doesn't mean that you throw out the consideration altogether. In one case I cited in my brief, an officer testified that an area was pretty active, didn't exactly say high crime, just said pretty active. And the defendant argued that was vague and meaningless testimony, but the court still gave it some weight, perhaps less weight than if there were more information, but it still deserves some weight.
Counsel, the United States Supreme Court, I think, has used this as a relevant factor, correct? Okay. So in this situation, we are working within the framework that the United States Supreme Court has adopted. In some respects, we are operating as a lower appellate court interpreting and applying United States Supreme Court decisions. It strikes me to be difficult for us to minimize that as a factor if the court has said it's a relevant factor for constitutional purposes. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. So I would like to talk a little bit more, unless there are more questions about the high crime area factor. And I would like to talk a little bit more about the nighttime factor, because that one might seem a little bit innocuous, but I think it is a pretty significant factor. And I think maybe a helpful illustration is, let's say that my house has a surveillance camera system outside pointing at the front door. And let's say my phone notifies me that somebody is approaching my front door at 3:30 in the afternoon. I'm not going to be very concerned because I'll assume it's just a FedEx employee delivering something that I bought online. But if my phone notifies me at 3:30 in the morning that somebody is approaching my front door, now I'm going to be a lot more concerned because some behavior in the afternoon is not suspicious. But when the same behavior happens late at night, now suddenly it seems more suspicious. And I think that's exactly what we have in this case with the suspected drug deal happened at 3:30 in the morning. And I think it's helpful. So my briefs talk about all the different facts in this case, and I categorize them as either four or five different facts. And now in sort of 2020 hindsight, I think that there might be actually, I think you can break them down into six different facts. And I think it's helpful to really group them into kind of three different categories maybe. So we have the timing consideration, the drug reputation, and then we have Genesis Car. And if I say genus, I'm sorry if that's a mispronunciation, but that's the way I've been saying it for the past year. So I think if we turn to the timing group first, there are really two important facts here. One is, like I said, 3:30 in the morning is when the officer saw the suspected drug deal. But I think the other really important timing consideration is that this woman, who we believe was Kayla, entered Genesis' car for just 10 to 15 seconds. And I think it was one of the cases I cited, either one of the First Circuit cases, either the Trello one I talked about today, I think that's the one that it was, that said a brief interaction, I think in that case it was 20, 30 seconds. The court said, there's not really a whole lot you can do in 20, 30 seconds. Like you're not reading a magazine together. You're probably not getting together to talk if it's just 15 or 20 seconds. Same kind of thing here. And sure, Janice posits a lot of innocent possible explanations in his brief. Like maybe he was there to pick up a cell phone he left at Kayla's house or something. But I guess my question would be, why wouldn't he just hand something to her through the window if it's something innocuous, like a wallet or cell phone that he forgot or that she left behind at his house? So I think one reasonable assumption that Officer Stickle could make is that Kayla got into the car to make some sort of transfer so that people, if they were watching, wouldn't be able to see it inside of the car, unlike seeing something change hands through the window. So those are the two, I think, important time considerations. It's for the reputational stuff, the sort of second kind of category. I think there are also a couple of considerations here. One I talked about already with Justice Dallet, which is the reputation of the area as a not just a high crime area, but a high drug trafficking area. But the other, perhaps more important, I think, consideration is that this woman who entered Genesis's car had a reputation for being a heavy heroin user or heavy drug user. And Officer Stickle knew before he pulled over Genesis's car that this woman who entered his car matched the physical description of this Kayla woman. And he also knew that Kayla lived in the house that this woman came from and went back to. And he knew that Kayla was a, I guess, known drug user, heavy drug user. And he knew that from his fellow police officers who have worked with her, and she's been arrested several times for various drug offenses. She provided that address, that home address, as her address when she was arrested. And the police also worked with her in some capacity. I'm not entirely sure, maybe as an informant or something. So they were pretty familiar. The police department was very familiar with her drug history, and officers took note that she was still using drugs at the time of this incident. And I see that Justice Dale has unmuted herself.
Well, I just had a question for you, Ms. Rosenau. I just don't know that it's as clear from the record what it meant by the physical description. This officer's knowledge, I mean, he knew that that was her home address. Did he just know that it was a white female? I mean, I didn't get from the record that he had a real description so that he could identify that person as Kayla. And by the way, we have to consider the other parts of the transcript where he's parked a block away. There's no street light. It's dark. I wonder how much weight that carries as well in terms of this description of understanding that this was the person.
Sure. So a couple of points. First, I'll address the sort of darkness consideration. So Officer Stickle testified that this woman who he thought was Kayla ran under the streetlights when she went to Janice's car. So Janice's car was parked across the street from her house, maybe one house south of her address. So Kayla had to run across the street to get to Janice's car, and she went around his car to get inside the passenger side. And she ran under the streetlights because Officer Stickle testified there were two streetlights across the street from Kayla's house. So he did get a pretty good look at her when she ran under the streetlight. And I'll admit that he did maybe use sort of cop speak when he said, I saw her physicals, is the term that he used a couple of times. They looked up her physicals. And he didn't say exactly what that meant. I assume it means more than just white female. It probably means things like race, sex, height, weight, perhaps age. He could have been clearer on exactly what he meant by physicals, but I think it probably meant all those things. And even if it just meant white female, I think there's probably still enough to assume that this person was Kayla because she came from Kayla's home address and still having the same sex and race as her suggested to her. And also the fact that she engaged in behavior consistent with a drug deal and knowing that this Kayla person had a history as a heavy drug user, I think all those things kind of suggest that it really was her. And I think that basically facts give meaning to other facts. And I think some facts can kind of corroborate each other. So I think that the fact that this behavior was suspicious of a drug deal helps corroborate that this was Kayla in the first place. I did mention that there was a third kind of category of facts that I wanted to address in terms of Genesis's car. And I think there are a couple of considerations here too. One is the headlights, which my brief went into. I can talk about that more. But the other one that in hindsight, I probably should have emphasized more in my briefing is that Dennis's car was registered to somebody in Milwaukee, and this suspected drug deal happened in West Allis. And Officer Stickle considered the fact that it was an out-of-town car before he pulled it over. And that's important because at a few different places in his testimony, he said that a common form of drug dealing in West Allis involves a drug car coming from out of town, stopping in front of the buyer's house, making the deal in the car, and then going. And
okay, Mr. Rosenau, have you been to Milwaukee?
I have.
Okay, is West Allis out of town from Milwaukee or vice versa? Will a car from Milwaukee registered in the city of Milwaukee out of town when it goes to West Allis? Because that's what we're talking about here, West Allis and Milwaukee.
I acknowledge that West Allis is very close to Milwaukee. It's one of the closer
suburbs. I think that one was a stretch. I get the whole out of town thing potentially and some other future situation. The other thing I'd ask you is, do all cars coming from Milwaukee, is there some kind of drug dealing aspect to cars registered there too, or you're not going to go there?
I'm not going to go there because Officer Stickle didn't go there. Had he said that a lot of the drug dealing comes from the city of Milwaukee, then I think we'd have a stronger case for saying that Milwaukee was significant. And I'll admit Officer Stickle said that just seeing a car from Milwaukee in West Allis at 3:30 in the morning just by itself is not suspicious or anything out of the ordinary. But I think that it's still entitled to at least a little bit of weight because he did say that a lot of the drug dealing in West Allis involves out-of-town cars. Probably not all of it, but at least some of it. So it is something that the court might want to consider giving some weight to.
And of course, counsel, in the Fourth Amendment analysis, we don't look at these factors in isolation. We look at them collectively as we evaluate the totality of the circumstances, correct?
Right. So I think one really helpful analogy that the case law uses, and it's in some of my one or both of my briefs, is this sort of building blocks concept. That each suspicious fact is a building block, and that eventually when you put them all together, you're building something that's basically the whole is greater than the sum of the individual parts. So it's not like just taking a bunch of blocks or bricks and throwing them into the yard into a pile. It's taking them and then making something out of them, like a wall or like a patio or something, where you actually kind of have to look at the picture as a whole, not just at all the individual blocks. And when all the pieces kind of fit together as a puzzle or something, then you kind of get the whole clear picture of what's going on. And I think if the court does that in this case, I really don't see how it would not find reasonable suspicion under these facts. The Court of Appeals found reasonable suspicion in Wisconsin in a case called Allen, which I think is very on point, and I relied on that heavily in my briefing, but the Court of Appeals didn't address that case even once. And I think that case shows that a short interaction in a vehicle late at night in a high crime area is suggestive of drug dealing. And that's really the significant facts in that case. So in that case, the officers didn't even know who the people in the car were. They just suspected that one of them was either the defendant or his companion he was with, but they didn't know who the other person was. But in this case, I think, as I talked about, I think we have a strong assumption that the person who got into the car was a known drug user, known heavy heroin user named Kayla. So I think that fact, along with the headlights, really pushes this one even farther than the Allen case. The final fact that I didn't
know. Ms. Fresnel, let me just ask you a question about the timing. Because in looking through the cases and even that case that we discussed last week, I feel like the timing could go both ways. That is that you could have a short interaction and you might argue that would be indicative of drug use, or you could have a longer interaction. And so I'm trying to sort it out in my own head whether or not in the end there's any significance to the amount of time that someone is in a vehicle. Can you help me sort that out?
Right. So I think one of the important points is that Officer Stickle testified that commonly, at least in his training and experience, drug dealing that happens in cars usually is pretty quick, that these drug dealers usually don't like to just sit around for a long time waiting for the deal to go through. So I think that's one important reason why the short timing is significant. I think the other reason why is because it helps eliminate some innocent explanations. Obviously, police don't have to rule out innocent explanations before making a stop. And the law recognizes that the innocent people might get stopped sometimes lawfully because reasonable suspicion is a very low standard. But I think the short timing here rules out some possible explanations, like perhaps two people will get together in a car just because they haven't seen each other in a while. They want to get together and talk for 10 minutes or something and catch up. But there's not really a whole lot you can say in just 10 seconds besides hi and bye. So I think the short timing does eliminate some innocent inferences. So really the only innocent explanations that Genesis brief throws out for consideration are things like handing a wallet or a cell phone that one person forgot at the other person's house. But like I said, if they were just doing that, why wouldn't they hand it through the window? Why would she go around his car, go into the passenger side and get in there for 10 to 15 seconds if she's just grabbing a cell phone, which she could have done through the window? So the final fact that I did want to talk about today is the headlights activity, which I think is kind of the final consideration regarding Genesis' car. So it's not just that the headlights went off and on, but I think it's, again, considering all of the facts together collectively, like Justice Bradley pointed out. So I think if you look at the fact that Janice turned off his headlights a few seconds before Kayla came out of her house and got into his car, and right after Officer Stickle parked half a block behind Janice's car, I think it's safe to assume that Janice might have seen a car pull up behind him half a block away, or he at least might have thought that somebody was maybe looking out the window, or somebody might have been on the sidewalk, and he just wanted to avoid detection. Again, this is all just one reasonable inference to make, and that to avoid detection, to avoid people seeing into the car, he turned the lights off. And then a few seconds after Kayla ran out of his, got out of his car and ran back into her house, then he turned his headlights back on. And one point I do want to make, I think my brief says that Janice left his car, that he turned off the lights but left the car running. And that's the way I interpreted Officer Stickle's testimony. But reading the transcript again yesterday, I think Officer Stickle didn't say one way or the other whether Janice's car was still on. Officer Stickle said that he saw that Janice's car was running because he saw exhaust emitting from the tailpipe when the lights were on. So I guess that suggests that maybe once the lights went off, maybe the engine went off too. And the circuit court, on I think it's page 89 of the motion hearing transcript, the circuit court seems to say that Janice turned off his engine along with the car. So honestly, I don't really know whether Janice's car was on or off. All I know is that his headlights went off for sure, but I don't think it, again, just duty of candor to the tribunal. I don't know if the engine actually went off in Janice's car, but I don't think it makes a big difference one way or the other. I think all that really matters here in terms of the car is that the headlights went off right after the officer pulled up behind him and right before Kayla got into his car. Then they went back on right when Kayla left. So I think that factor standing alone maybe wouldn't be a huge consideration, because when a car parks and stops and shuts off, the headlights usually go off. But I think if the court looks at the headlight activity in terms of the timing of Kayla getting in and out, the officer stopping behind Janice, and it considers the other suspicious activity collectively, I think the headlights activity does have some significance and should get some weight. And I see I still have 5 minutes, but I certainly don't need to fill those 5 minutes. So unless the court has more questions, I can just talk during my 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
I just want to ask about one thing in your brief that you didn't talk about, and that was the fact that no, that was in the defense brief. I'm going to wait for Mr. August. Never mind.
Okay. Well, I'm done for now then. Thank you.
Okay. Attorney August, are you prepared to begin?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Christopher August. I'm here representing Mr. James Janice, the defendant appellant, the citizen whose Fourth Amendment rights are at issue in this case. I'm here today asking this court to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals, which held that Mr. Janice's rights were violated and that the evidence should have been suppressed. In looking at this case, there's, I think, really two issues presented for the court's review. There's the very central issue of the Fourth Amendment inquiry, the reasonable suspicion inquiry. Intertwined with and in some ways connected to that is this issue of the high crime area and the request for more regulation and guidance as set forth in Janice's response brief. Looking at the reasonable suspicion inquiry, I think there's three things that are very important to keep in mind. Number one, it was the state's burden at the hearing held in this case to establish reasonable suspicion. If there are gaps or omissions, or there's areas where we have to make guesses or assumptions, as the state suggests, I think that is very relevant to whether the state has shown that reasonable suspicion existed. Number two, going back to Terry versus Ohio, the United States Supreme Court has been very clear that there's a difference between a hunch and reasonable suspicion. In other words, there's a difference between what we can assume and specific articulable facts that we can utilize to establish reasonable suspicion. And number three, while Justice Bradley is absolutely correct that we do need to look at the totality of the circumstances, I think it first needs to start with a proper sorting and weighing of the specific factors. In other words, we're not just handed a final package and asked to look at that holistically or just look at that at its surface value. We're supposed to look at the ingredients that have gone into that package. what is making it up? In the state's analogy, they talk about a wall. Well, we don't just look at the wall. We're looking closer to see if the wall is well built, to see if it's structurally sound. And if there's bricks that are falling apart or there's mortar that's falling off, that's an issue for us from a constitutional perspective. So in this case, I think the state's approach to reasonable suspicion, I think the best example of their problematic approach is I'm going to jump all the way to their issue of headlights, which they brought up towards the end of the argument. And to me, this really epitomizes the state's problematic way of treating the reasonable suspicion inquiry. Because what the state wants to do is they want to go through this record. They want to identify these specific discrete data points. They want to take those, stretch and distort them, and present them to this court as if they establish reasonable suspicion. Well, the headlights are problematic because let's start with the fact that there's nothing illegal about turning your headlights off. I don't even think it's inherently ambiguous conduct. I think it's inherently innocent conduct. It's something that citizens do millions of times a day. I think actually probably if you're parked in a residential neighborhood, you're possibly acting politely by turning your headlights off while you're parked outside someone's house.
Counsel, I'm going to stop you there because your argument goes back to what I think is a principal criticism from the state. And I think I agree with that. You're looking at each factor in isolation. So, of course, turning headlights on and off in isolation doesn't give rise to reasonable suspicion. I agree with you. But when we add that into the other factors, and I guess I don't know if I would use your wall analogy. I'd use a picture analogy or a movie analogy. When I'm looking at the big picture, we have somebody pull up to the house of a known heroin user. She runs out of the house, gets in the car for seconds, and then runs back into her house. To me, whether he turned the headlights on or off is neither here nor there. I think you got reasonable suspicion with just those factors. The headlights is maybe a little something added on to the picture to further support reasonable suspicion, but I don't think it's necessary. And so that's what how I struggled when I read your brief. You took each factor in isolation, but you didn't paint the picture. So can you tell me, how are you not looking at each factor in isolation is my question.
So I certainly understand Your Honor's point. I think, though, what the court's required to do in assessing reasonable suspicion is I do think before we look at the overall picture, we're determining whether the evidence satisfied this constitutional bar. And we have to determine what factors are properly included on the scale and what weight those individual factors are given. And then certainly once we make a decision, right, which factors we think are relevant and what weight they should be given, then we look overall at do those factors taken together, do they satisfy the constitutional bar? And my point is that when we start looking closer at these factors, some of them turn out to be irrelevant or not very relevant at all, or they have other embedded problems in them.
That's not looking at the totality of the circumstances, because if you're asking the court to start eliminating factors before we even look at the total picture or the totality of the circumstances, that seems to completely reverse what the United States Supreme Court has instructed us as the proper approach in these Fourth Amendment analyses.
So I obviously think that you need to look at factors in context and you need to assess how factors might relate to each other. I'm not denying that. I'm certainly not advocating a position where we go in a vacuum and we just look at things totally siloed. But I still think you need to examine the underlying factual problems, the use of assumptions that are being used to bridge gaps. And I think that that factors into the reasonable suspicion calculus. You know, at the end of the day, I think that this case is very close to what the court was discussing in Terry. The difference between a hunch and reasonable suspicion. The officer in this case was on the scene very briefly, and he was candid that he didn't have a lot of context for what he was observing. He didn't know how long Mr. Jenness had been parked in the car. He didn't know whether he had just parked his car when he turned the headlights off. He knew for certain, and or at least he thought, that Mr. Jenness hadn't seen him. And so the idea that he was concealing himself from law enforcement, I think, is questionable in light of the record that the state elicited in the trial court. But he sees this brief encounter, and he jumps to an assumption, a hunch, that this must be drug activity. In order for the state to satisfy its constitutional burden, it needs to present more than this hunch or this assumption. You know, the state said multiple times in its argument, we can assume, or I assume the description was more robust, or it's safe to assume. We're not here to make assumptions. We're here to look at specific, articulable facts, which taken together establish the constitutionally requisite reasonable suspicion. So in this case, for example, he observes an interaction between two citizens. He's not sure what he's seen. He hasn't seen, for example, he didn't see Ms. Cienko come out of her home holding money. He never saw any money. He doesn't see her leave the car with anything in her hand. He doesn't see her secreting or concealing anything on her person. He certainly didn't see anything inside of the car. In fact, he was candid that he couldn't see what was going on inside of the car. And based on this, without really any specific objective facts that he looks at, he makes an assumption. This must be a drug deal. The Constitution requires more. And I think the state's trying to bootstrap its weak evidence that was elicited in the trial court with some of these generic assumptions and problematic contextual considerations. For example, timing. The state emphasizes time of night in their petition and in their brief and in their argument today. I think that this is problematic, really, one reason, which is our Constitution doesn't recognize a daytime and a nighttime constitution. Reasonable suspicion exists, whether it's night or it's day. It's clear, I think, that this court has said in prior cases that time of night can be relevant. I'll concede that. But time of night needs to be connected to something else. For example, if we look at this court's jurisprudence on OWIs, I think that that's very instructive to us. If an officer, for example, is on patrol on Saturday night and sees someone weaving within their lane, as in the Post case, maybe varying their speed, undertaking actions on the highway which are ambiguous, but the officer could say, you know, it's just after bar time, this person's driving from downtown, it's more reasonable for me to infer that this person might be operating under the influence. Time of night is relevant in that case because we've tied time of night to some other consideration. We're not just using it in isolation as things are more suspicious just because it's night. We've tied it back into the facts of the case and what the officer is looking at. In this case, the officer didn't testify that drug dealing was something that only occurs at night. In fact, the officer indicated people sell drugs during the day, they sell drugs at night. So if people are selling drugs both during the day and at night, I don't think night is inherently relevant because it hasn't been properly connected to other facts or circumstances that make it reasonable to rely on time of night.
Isn't it connected back to the fact that the officer observed someone, a woman, meeting the description of a known heroin user, running into the car at 3:30 in the morning and then leaving just seconds later? Isn't that enough? Reasonable suspicion is a pretty low bar, isn't it?
So I think that there's a couple embedded issues in Your Honor's question that I want to touch on. And I think one of them that's circling around the case is this issue of this was the description of a known heroin user, that this was Ms. Cienko, and therefore it's more suspicious because it's Ms. Cienko. I think there's two problems. I think Justice Dallet pointed this out in her questioning, that we really don't know, I think, whether this was Kayla Cienko or not. The state didn't really establish at the hearing, at which time they had the burden of proving that reasonable suspicion existed, what exactly the officer was basing his judgment that this was Kayla Cienko on. The officer said she matched a description. He was clear he'd never seen a photograph of her, but he had received some kind of description via email, and we just don't know from this record what that is. So I would posit, number one, the assumption that this is Kayla Cienko is weighted lesser because of the kind of empirical and objective issues surrounding was this Kayla Cienko. However, even if we're going to give the state the benefit of the doubt and say this was Kayla Cienko, I don't think that our Constitution establishes that just because an individual has a historical drug problem, because somebody struggles with drug addiction, that because of that, they are subject to state-sponsored monitoring, and their actions are more inherently suspicious just because of their own personal struggles that they've had at some point in their life, or that any person who happens to cross their path or interact with them is somehow now the target of a coercive police action, a seizure, just because they happen to interact with someone who has historically struggled with drug addiction. I don't think that that is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment.
Counsel, I agree with you, but there's no state-sponsored monitoring of this woman, right? The officer happened upon this area. It's not like he was camped out at her house just trying to catch somebody in the act of a drug transaction, right?
That's correct. And so to the extent that my rhetorical flourish might have been overbroad, but I think that that's a good way to kind of segue into some of this authority cited by the state, and particularly the Allen case, and talk about why their authority is not really on point. The state really wants to analogize this to Allen, and that is a case involving pretty intensive monitoring of a neighborhood, that I think could safely be described as a high crime area on steroids. Right? There is a tremendous amount of activity in this neighborhood that is meriting an unusual and heavy law enforcement response of all kinds of surveillance and monitoring. And it's in that context that the police observe the suspicious interaction involving a car, which leads to the seizure. This case is different. The officer testified generically that this was a high crime area, but didn't really support that with the same articulable justifications and at least the same extremely significant explanation like we see in the Allen case. So that's a good point to segue, I think, into the high crime area consideration, because I think that this case really shows the problems that can attend to the usage of the high crime area criterion.
Mr. August, how do you respond to Justice Hagedorn's question to Mr. Rosenau about how the Supreme Court has recognized, the United States Supreme Court has recognized that a high crime area can be a relevant to the determination of reasonable suspicion? How do you respond to that?
So I would say two things. I would say, number one, we're not disputing that a high crime area is not relevant. We're not asking this court to overrule its prior decisions, and we're certainly not asking this court to overrule the United States Supreme Court decisions on the relevance of the high crime area. I think under the Fourth Amendment reasonable suspicion inquiry, there still has to be reasonableness, and whether the officer's labeling of the areas as high crime is reasonable is, I think, relevant. But kind of separate from that, the petition or the response to the petition filed by Mr. Jenness and the brief filed by Mr. Jenness talk about how this court has authority under the Wisconsin Constitution, under its superintending authority, to promote the fair administration of justice, to set forth rules and guidelines that lower courts can utilize when considering the high crime area criterion. So when we look at what type of guidance the court could promulgate, the brief sets forth a couple of ideas. And I think probably the most relevant is requiring that there be some sort of proof, some sort of objective justification for this area being labeled as high crime in the form of facts or data. Because really the issue, as I see it, involves an interplay between three considerations. We've got on the one hand, the fact that the high crime area criterion is uniquely powerful. It acts unlike any other consideration because it's atmospheric, right? Once high crime area is invoked, it suffuses that totality of the circumstances analysis, and it renders other perhaps ambiguous conduct more suspicious just by virtue of the fact that it occurred in this high crime area. It is, in many cases, a way of putting a thumb on the scale toward a finding of reasonable suspicion. Now, despite the fact that it is powerful and that it has this effect, and when we look at other cases and when we do a Westlaw search and we look at how often this is being invoked to justify seizures and searches, officers and the state are not required to really explain with a lot of detail why this very powerful, very persuasive criterion is being invoked. In other words, under the existing state of the law, officers are free to come into court and say, this was a high crime area. Counsel, and there's no further...
Counselor, are you aware of any other factors that this court has determined or the United States Supreme Court has determined are relevant in a totality of the circumstances analysis, where this court has undertaken to prescribe particular procedures to govern a trial court's findings of fact in a hearing? What strikes me is what you're asking us to do. You're asking us to impose certain kinds of evidentiary requirements to govern trial court findings of fact in hearings like this, as opposed to letting the parties duke it out through adversarial litigation and allow the trial courts to do what they are there to do in many cases, which is to find precisely these sorts of facts based on the evidence that the parties present. So are you aware of any other factors where this court has superimposed evidentiary requirements like this?
I'm not, but I also think that the high crime area criterion is special and it's unique. And I think that if, as a justice system, we are serious about addressing disparities and unequal treatment in our justice system, I think that the high crime area criterion is one target that the court could address. Because obviously, high crime areas are not uniformly distributed across Wisconsin. They're not uniformly distributed across the Milwaukee metropolitan area. In fact, we know that there is a correlation between whether a neighborhood is majority-minority and whether it is going to be labeled as high crime. We know that there is a situation in which, as the scholarship points out in the brief, that individuals who are minorities are, by virtue of wide variety of socioeconomic factors, historical segregation, still existing structural racism, poverty, what have you, are stuck, are trapped in neighborhoods where they must live and work. And those neighborhoods are then denominated as high crime areas, meaning that when they undertake certain ambiguous conduct in that neighborhood, that would not be suspicious if they were in Whitefish Bay or Glendale. It is now inherently suspicious or problematic in that neighborhood. They are penalized.
Is there a way to do this besides through a rule, which does have potential problems with in terms of the substantive nature of it as opposed to it being more procedural? So is there a way that you would ask this court to cabin the high crime area analysis in some other way?
Unfortunately, I'm not. I mean, obviously, reasonable suspicion, we always need to look at reasonableness. So I think that there's cases in which we could use that framework to push back if it doesn't appear reasonable for an officer to label somewhere as a high crime area, or it appears that that's perhaps just flatly at odds with the evidence. I think that might be a situation, or we have an officer who comes into court and says the entire north side of Milwaukee is a high crime area. But I think in general, if we really want to drill down and we really want to prohibit an overbroad reading of the high crime area, we want to prohibit this from morphing into something that fuels more unequal policing and unequal treatment in our criminal justice system, I think really the only way to do it is to adopt some standards and require the state to provide a justification before they rely on it. I'm not saying that the state cannot rely on the high crime area criterion. I'm not saying that because again, the United States Supreme Court has said that that's what to do. But if we're going to do that, we need to make sure it's being done surgically. It's being done precisely, and that there's a basis that is being put forth before we do that.
Don't the circuit court judges themselves serve as a check on police coming into the courtroom to say, this is a high crime area? I mean, the circuit court judges all over the state live in these communities. So, you know, Milwaukee is quite large, but still circuit court judges do have an understanding of the neighborhoods to some extent, at least, right? So if a police officer comes in and suggests that an area or asserts that an area is high crime, the circuit court judge is a check on those claims and the strength of those claims, right?
So I think certainly a circuit court judge can be. I think two responses to that would be, I'm not sure how often that's happening. But also, number two, I think as well-intentioned as it might be and as hard as our circuit court judges might try, I think it's also a problem to just kind of fall back on the circuit court judge's subjective judgment that might be in their head when they're hearing the testimony of, oh yeah, I recognize that neighborhood, that's a problematic neighborhood. I think we need something more objective. We need something on the record, something that's verifiable and that can be checked against facts or data. And also just requiring the state to really put, really drill down on what they mean when this is a high crime area. Is it geographically bounded? Are you talking about two blocks, or are you talking about the entire River West neighborhood in Milwaukee? Is it temporarily bounded? Is this a high crime neighborhood in terms of what? In terms of it's been a lot of calls in the last week? Or we all know historically that, you know, Keefe and whatever is a quote unquote bad neighborhood. And I think most importantly, requiring a linkage between the type of criminal activity that's suspected and the type of high crime area we're discussing. In other words, if someone's going to say this is a high crime area, to say it's a high drug crime area or it's a high whatever crime area, and require that that be connected to the facts of the case. If it's a high crime area because there's been burglaries and stickups, that's different if we're dealing with a drug case, I think.
Well, Mr. August, instead of the court potentially making a rule the way you've confined it in terms of all these pieces, are you asking us to merely require that there be a clear and specific record, that courts are not just to accept this general idea that an officer says it's a high crime area and therefore we take that as a fact?
I think that that would go a long way in resolving some of the issue. I think certainly that would be a start to at least require that it's not just a conclusory assertion by an officer without any further pushback or analysis, that there at least be something present to explain why, again, this uniquely powerful justification that has these broader socioeconomic implications is being relied on to impinge or infringe upon somebody's rights. So I think requiring a record and some justification as a starting point, but I think we can go further than that. And I think that the brief lays out some really specific ideas based on the scholarly research and some things that the other courts have done to address and really make it as precise and specific and calculated as possible to ensure that we're not impermissibly subjecting people who happen to live in high crime area and, you know, poor neighborhoods that they're quote unquote have less constitutional rights. And, you know, I know the state's perspective on this, as they set forth in their brief, is that, you know, we need to protect ghetto residents from crime, is how they phrase it in their brief. And I agree that people who live in these neighborhoods need to be protected from crime, but they also have constitutional rights. And I just frankly don't think it's acceptable that activity which I might undertake, walking in my neighborhood of Glendale at 2 o'clock in the morning, is not going to be cause for concern. But if I'm on the other side of Silver Spring in Milwaukee, it is going to be cause for concern. I think that's problematic. And I think if we're going to use that presence on the other side of Silver Spring in some way, we better have a good justification for it. And that's what I'm asking this court to articulate. So I see my time is almost up. I don't have further points, but I'm happy to respond to any further questions that there might be from the court.
Any other questions? Okay, Attorney Rosenau, I think we're prepared for you to proceed with rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. So just to make clear, I did rely on a lot of facts today, but I just want to make clear that they're not all entitled to equal weight. I think the most important facts in this case are the timing facts, so 10 to 15 seconds in the car at 3:30 in the morning. And the next most important facts are the reputation, the drug reputations. Most significantly is the woman, Kayla, her reputation is a heavy drug user. And I realize that I might have used words like assume or assumption when I spoke earlier today, but I was just being a little imprecise. I probably should have said things like rational inference. So if I had said something like Officer Stickle could assume that this woman was Kayla, what I really meant was I think a rational inference is that this woman was Kayla, and that's all that reasonable suspicion demands is a rational inference. I think the next most significant fact is the reputation of the area. And Janis talks a lot in his brief, and then of course Attorney August today, about the high crime area factor. But I think that's really a red herring in this case, because the officer didn't say that this area was a high crime area. He said it's a high drug trafficking area. And that's important because he stopped Janis on suspicion of drug dealing. So if the area were a high crime area with maybe a lot of burglaries, then I don't think that that would be entitled to any weight if there, in this case, where there was suspicion of drug dealing. So I think there is a linkage between the two, the reputation of the area and the activity that the officer observed.
All right, and Attorney Rosenau, when you say the officer saying that it's a high drug trafficking area, are you saying that's all officers need to do is just make that assertion without any kind of specifics?
No, Your Honor. I suppose if an officer did just say that, then I think it would still be entitled to at least a little bit of weight. But in this case, the officer was asked by the prosecutor, how do you know it was a high drug trafficking area? Did you learn that sort of thing at the start of your shifts and briefings? And the officer said he learned it during assemblies and briefings and things like that. So other officers either assembled or briefed him in on these sorts of things. So I don't think it's just his hunch based on just driving around the area. I think he learns it from other officers. The final two facts I want to talk about, which I think are the least significant facts, are the car ones. So the out-of-town registration and the headlights. I think if we get rid of those facts and just ignore them altogether, I think there's still easily reasonable suspicion based on the timing facts and the reputation facts. But the main reason why I wanted to talk about things like out-of-town registration and headlights is because some case law, like Vito and Gammons, seems, or at least the defense bar cites those cases to mean that out-of-town cars don't matter in reasonable suspicion analysis. But I don't think that's accurate. I think that it can matter in some cases. And I just wanted the court to clarify that point of law. And as far as the headlights go, the Court of Appeals below said the headlights don't matter, even though they went off. And I think it would be helpful for this court to clarify that headlights activity like this can be suspicious. It's not always suspicious. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's more suspicious in certain cases. And in this case, it's maybe somewhere in between either extreme. But like I said, we can ignore the out-of-town car and the headlights activity, and we still easily have reasonable suspicion with the other facts. I think I might have just one or two more points to make, but nothing too much to say. The final point I want to talk about is the time of night. So Attorney August said that there needs to be some sort of linkage, and he talked about OWI cases, but even I don't think there really has to be a link between, like a correlation between drugs being trafficked at night in this community or something. I think it's just reasonable to assume that crime is more likely to occur late at night when there are fewer people outside and it's dark, so people, eyewitnesses, aren't really able to see what's going on. And as far as the OWI analogy goes, people can drive drunk any time of day. Some people go to the bar during the day, especially if they work night shift, they might go to the bar right when they get off in the morning. So I don't think that there's necessarily a huge connection between late at night and drunk driving. And it's not even, like some cases might say, if you're driving at bar close time at 2 a.m., that's significant. But other cases will say, like, driving at 10 o'clock at night is important for drunk driving. But I think that since people are able to drive drunk, or they can drive drunk in theory any time of the day, and they sometimes do, I don't think that the nighttime connection, the OWI analogy, is even super strong. So I don't think there needs to be a really strong connection between the time of night and the crime that's being committed. And as I noted in my brief, the Allen case by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals and a bunch of other federal case law has found time of night to be a relevant factor in finding reasonable suspicion of drug activity. And like I said, I think the reason why is because it's just more likely to assume that somebody will deal drugs at night when there really isn't anybody outside to see them doing it. So that's all I've got to say, unless the court has more questions. And I ask the court to reverse and remand for the Court of Appeals to consider the unresolved issues. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And thank you both for very good arguments and excellent briefs. We are going to adjourn now. And to my colleagues who may or may not know, we are having a extended fire alarm today. We always have a fire alarm on the first Wednesday of the month, but today it's going to be a little longer and a more involved. So we will not convene again for the second argument until 11:05. So we are adjourned.